So much of the buffer zone is crumbling and in disrepair. Many examples exist where you could once walk through the Green Line of Nicosia and gaze upon buildings such as the Eos Eirios and Eos Aiakos, also known as St. George's and St. Jacob's Chapels, both of which are dated to the early 12th century, the former having Crusader heraldry relating to the Knights Templar, and the latter being one of the oldest Greek Orthodox churches on the island of Cyprus. Sadly, the lack of maintenance allowed to be performed on such artefacts and left exposed to the elements, many structures like these fall disregarded, trapped in the buffer zone as priceless historical litter. In 1955, a wall on the northern ceasefire line in central Nicosia, with very little historical significance by comparison to the notable chapels, too succumbed to this fate. It had originally been erected in haste in 1974 by Turkish Cypriots fighting in the area with Greek Cypriots opposite them, who could see from their buildings the exposed area in which Turkish soldiers were trying to move across an open area of land east to west behind the green line separating them. As with much of the original ceasefire lines, the conscripts, volunteers and civilians engaged in the street battles have desperately used everything they could to build makeshift fortifications, bunkers and barriers. In the case of this particular wall, the Turkish side had used a collection of some 60 vintage-looking tea chests from a nearby storage facility. These are wooden made, approximately the height of your knee, and not 2 foot wide or deep. All 60 had an open top, i.e. no lid, where once Hessian material lined the chests and sealed the contents inside. The barricade made with these chests was stacked on top of each other, with the open side facing north, so as to give soldiers the ability to place their feet inside the boxes and view over the man-made wall, possibly even to use as firing positions. When in 1955 the tea chest wall collapsed, the new occupants of the Turkish Cypriot forces in the area rebuilt the wall, as expected. As time passed, the Greek Cypriot forces watching over this area and the wall protested to the UN that the empty chests were being filled with concrete or sandbags, thus reinforcing the wall, which is a violation of the ceasefire, as the UN dictates that the building of new or strengthening of existing military positions within 400 metres of the opposing ceasefire line is in contravention to the agreement. The Turkish forces dismissed the claims of them reinforcing the wall, but the UN was pressured further still by the Greek Cypriot National Guard to pursue action, or at least be allowed to inspect the wall for confirmation. In the end, a deal was brokered, and the Turkish forces agreed to turn all 60 chests around so that their empty insides would be revealed, facing south into the buffer zone. Hence, they could not be reinforced in the future, and the UN would be able to see this clearly during their patrols. However, like so many UN agreements to concessions with either opposing force, details were missed, timelines were not stipulated, and most verbal contracts were not agreed in writing. And so, in the case of Tea Chest Wall, the Turkish Cypriot forces kept their word, and they did turn the tea chest to reveal their emptiness. But they did so gleefully by only turning one of the 60 chests around each week for 14 months. When they ended this protracted ceremony and had reached the final stage of revealing another empty chest, they had a big party in view of the UN. Welcome to Cyprus Untold, the unbiased and unprecedented podcast taking you inside the last 50 years of the United Nations buffer zone. Your host is Samuel Lewis Blanc, production by Ceasefire Limited. Hos geldin, Kalia Theres. Hey listeners, I hope you all saw the amusing side of that story. I can still vividly remember being shown T. Chess Wall on my first ever walk through the Green Line, and I had a giggle then too at the audacity. I guess it's a nice change from the many upsetting stories that we're hearing at the moment, and it's a better outcome from our last tale of the opposing forces winding each other up. This time too was as much about tormenting the UN as it was the National Guard. But this is, as most of the tales I begin each episode with, many years, if not decades post 1974, which we still need to learn about and how this buffer zone came into being. Hopefully, though, many of you are beginning to see the torrid history we've discussed already, how the division is beginning to take place that leads to these incidents occurring. It might not make sense to us, and that's okay. It's also incredibly difficult to follow along all the timelines and the various protagonists. I really appreciate you all sticking with me and wanting to know more. I am still too being blown away every week when more people are subscribing and downloading the podcast from all over the world. I've even had some people contact me to ask for extra recommendations on best places to visit, restaurant ideas. I'm more than happy to keep sharing these and more, so feel free to keep messaging me. And if you follow me on Instagram, at Cyprus Untold, you'll find a steady flow of posts there where I share some of my top recommendations for visiting this wonderful island. I cannot recommend enough that you actually go there if you have not already. And if you're already a resident, I'm very jealous of you. I'm counting the days until I get on my next flight back. Perhaps some of you might want to tag along and I will give you a guided tour of Nicosia. Let me know if this is something anyone would be interested in. Right, a quick announcement now before we jump into the main body of episode 5. As a dedicated listener of Cyprus Untold, you already know that we are passionate about telling the Cyprus story and helping more people to discover why the buffer zone exists and why it endures. We have been on an incredible journey together in just 4 short episodes so far, exploring fascinating stories, untold, and diving deep into the history that has led to these unique situations arising. Now, I am excited to announce that you can become more involved with the podcast. As a VIP patron of our show through the Podbean Patron Program. If you sign up now, you'll be helping to improve the listening experience, invest in the launch of extra content and new initiatives, as well as helping to prolong the life of the podcast. It is a really simple process, and by joining this exclusive community for as little as $3, you too invest in our continuing success. The web address to secure your patron status is https://patron.podbean.com/Cyprus Untold. You can also find a link on the Cyprus Untold website and in the description to this episode. Easier still, just download the Podbean app, subscribe to Cyprus Untold, and hit the patron button on the podcast front page. Now, this isn't a one-way street. In return for your kind support, I have a few promises. Firstly, once we reach 12 months of operating costs covered by the patron program, I will donate a third of all patron contributions to the charity War Child, whose mission it is to protect, educate, and stand up for the rights of children living through conflict around the world. I believe, as does the charity, that no child should be part of war. Ever. Secondly, no matter how big or small your contribution is, once released, I will send you a free copy of my Nicosia guidebook, which will reveal locations you can see into the buffer zone from, stories connected to the areas you visit, and of course, recommendations and discounts for the best restaurants and places to stay. And if that isn't enough, you're also going to get advance notice and priority to attend all future guided tours of Cyprus that I will be hosting. So please sign up now. You have multiple options available. Spread the word and stay engaged. My utmost thanks and appreciation to you all. Another great step forward there for the podcast with the setup of the Patreon program. And thank you so much to those that have already started sending donations to the podcast. It's so appreciated. And I'm really excited about what the next steps are that I can do with those funds and improving the podcast and also the future initiatives that I want to take forward. So thanks again, guys. Really appreciate it. So let's get into episode 5. We ended the last episode with a quote from George Grievous, if you remember, leader of the Greek Cypriot paramilitary organization, EOCA, that's pre-1960 EOCA to be precise, in which he spoke of fighting for freedom. His words conveyed a tone of morality and justification for the murder of many innocent lives. And many people to this day still celebrate independence from the British in Cyprus. They judge, perhaps, that EOCA and Grievous did the right thing for the Cypriots, whom, without their violent uprising, Cyprus may not have gained independence, at least not for a few decades. And I'm sure that is a contentious and hotly debated subject still. What cannot be debated, in my humble opinion, and in the eyes of many who have studied what happens to Cyprus between 1960 to 1964, is that if there is any euphoria over 1960, it is short-lived and surely cannot be thought of without the nagging feeling of regret by what follows. I would add, it is Macarius III who subsequently needs to justify his actions and his decisions. So, to begin with a quote now by the one person who is at the heart of everything Cyprus between 60 to 64 and is arguably the one person who can honestly claim the utmost integrity for being unbiased in the Cyprus problem. Professor Ernst Forsthoff, whose title was Neutral President of the Supreme Constitutional Court of Cyprus. A judge from a neutral country with no experience of Cyprus whatsoever, he is placed in this role precisely for the purpose of being impartial at the top of the newly created Cypriot judicial system in 1960. He said at the end of 1963, and I quote, Makarios bears on his shoulders the sole responsibility of the recent tragic events. His aim to deprive the Turkish community of their rights. He continued, all this happened because Makarios wanted to remove all constitutional rights from the Turkish Cypriots. So what is he on about? What are these tragic events he is referencing? And what did Makarios do, or not, to warrant such a slur by the head of the judiciary in Cyprus? Let's go back now to 1960 and find out. So, the Republic of Cyprus is born, albeit as part of the Zurich and London Accords, Britain actually retains approximately 260 square kilometres of land on the island, mostly for military purposes. But let's discuss that in a separate episode in greater detail. For now, just accept that there remains a British military presence in Cyprus. And it's important to note that the United Kingdom is one of the guarantors of peace for Cyprus to this day, the others being Turkey and Greece. This is going to bear particular significance to the story as events unfold in 1974. To be clear, this is actually written into a treaty. It's called the 1960 Treaty of Guarantee, and it affords each country the right, in simple terms, to intervene on the island, if required, to restore, quote-unquote, territorial integrity and security for Cyprus. Just think, this is a new country. What does it need and what does it not have yet? Cyprus does not have its own military to defend itself, hence the need for the guarantor nations. But they are also deemed necessary due to the intercommunal violence that began emerging in the latter stages of the fight for independence. Now, to further strengthen the Cypriot state's start in life and to reflect the two communities, the constitutional arrangements are as follows. The Cypriot president is to be Greek Cypriot with a Turkish Cypriot vice president. Naturally, Makaris III takes up the chief role and the Turkish community's figurehead at the time accepts the vice role. The council of ministers below them is constructed with a ratio of 7 Greek to 3 Turkish Cypriots. This is based on a rough ratio with the constituents on the island. Now, this ratio is actually used right throughout the island, in municipalities, in the civil service. The entire structure of governance aims to have a bicommunal composition. But you tell me, is this really a good way to reflect society? It may, at first glance, seem perfectly legitimate. It's great, maybe appeasing to both Greek and Turkish Cypriots. But I would encourage you to think a little bit deeper and maybe imagine your own country that you are in right now. Having a government structure solely based on the ethnic demographics of your country, and actually only the predominant communities, the predominant two communities, because in Cyprus, there is also other minority groups in the Latins and Maronites, amongst others. Where is their place in this? Vice president? Question mark. The point I'm making is that this divide of roles just perpetuates the idea that there is just that, a divide. It is an oxymoron. The whole idea of representation for both communities, deliberately split by Greek and Turkish Cypriot ratios, it just reinforces the more extremist views that are still held, that Cyprus is either part of Greece or should be partitioned. I hope you are frustrated as I am, just thinking about what a colossus mistake this is. Yet, it is what happened. And so, from the very start, there are problems with this setup for Cyprus. Turkish Cypriots, remember, under British rule for the last 7 decades, have been relatively passive politically, having enjoyed a somewhat symbiotic relationship with the British, relying on each other to combat Enosis. Now, however, at the forefront of this new state and all its inner workings, plus the emergence of the Turkish Cypriot paramilitary group, TMT, a direct result of EOKA in the 1950s, remember, Turkish nationalism is gaining substantial traction in the Turkish community of Cyprus. Makarios does not help to alleviate their fears either. In fact, he is totally consumed by the idea that the Greek Cypriot community could itself split, and he fears civil war between those who fought for Enosis and many still wanted to achieve this, and there are those who accepted the status quo, or the new status quo, I should say. Remember, Makarios, he paused. He was hesitant to sign the accords and make Cyprus independent. And even though he did, it is widely accepted now that he only viewed this as a stepping stone towards Enosis. He had been at the vanguard of this idea for the previous decade, and many ordinary Greek Cypriots now knew very little else, except that this was the goal. And some felt betrayed by Makarios signing over land to the British, giving Turkish Cypriots a place at the political table. And in theory, he had given up the mandate for Enosis. Add all this together, and you can see why Makarios was worried about a backlash in the Greek Cypriot communities, even a possible return to violence on the streets. But instead of it being a fight for freedom from colonial rule, it would be Greek Cypriots turning on one another, and in the aftermath, a possible opportunity for Turkish Cypriots to rise to power. You may think this a far-fetched possibility, but for Makarios and other leaders at the time in Cyprus, it was a very real concern. And so they needed to appease the extremists, as they saw it, to prevent civil war in their own community. Let's take a quick break before we rejoin the story and find out what Makarios plans to do. Welcome back again to episode 5 of Cyprus Untold. It's going to be heavy going. There's a lot of political jargon, and it's difficult to get our heads around all the problems that are emerging in the early 60s. But do stick with me. It's going to be worth it. If you don't quite follow along, just reach out to me and I can make sure I connect the dots better for you. Let's continue. Makarios is gravely concerned about civil war. The constitutional makeup between Greek and Turkish Cypriots is hitting stumbling blocks at every turn. Veto powers given to the president and vice president are being enacted daily as each struggle to pander to their ethnic communities' wants and wishes. This renders the government ineffective, and as with the tit-for-tat killings that began in 1958, you can almost witness the political manifestation of this as Greek and Turkish Cypriots tussle for advantage over one another. And this permeates right through the island and into every institution, further sowing the idea of division between the two communities who once lived so peacefully side by side. It's incredibly sad. Thankfully, during this initial period of independence, there is very little appetite for violence. Let's not forget, a whole generation has been embroiled in fighting the British, plus the outbreak of assassinations against Cypriots themselves. So there's a relative pause on the island in reports of intercommunal killings. And with the British focused on themselves, now behind the wire of the sovereign base areas on the southern edges of Cyprus, plus the retained sites that they maintained control of right across the island, there is very little external commentary we can draw on for this time. Perhaps there is more to discover in Cypriot newspapers of the time, and if someone wants to message me and educate me on this, I would love to know more. What I can be certain of, however, the underground organisations that perpetrated the majority of the violence in the 1950s, i.e. EOKA, and in a small part TMT, these groups are actually starting to become revived in 61 and 62. There is a small presence of Turkish mainland army troops on the island, something allowed under the Treaty of Alliance, and the same is true of the Greek mainland military also. Through connections to these, TMT and EOKA, now dubbed EOKA B to distinguish them from the 1950s EOKA, they are able to smuggle weapons onto the island, although any call to action and use these weapons is left dormant for now. Back to the political scene. Impasse after impasse. It's just constant stalemate as municipalities and the government of Cyprus fail to make their bicommunal experiment work. The only thing I can point to as a positive during this time, Cyprus joins the UN, it is admitted to the Commonwealth, and it becomes a member of the International Monetary Fund, aka IMF, as well as the World Bank. Great positives. But without the ability to enact local policies for distributing wealth, for example, or without agreement on development projects, because every single idea is met with contempt and suspicion of trying to improve the lives of one community over the other. These affiliations on the world stage are meaningless. And so, in order to break this political deadlock, Makarios proposes in late 1963 13 amendments to the constitution. Without wanting to list all of them here and now, I will give you a flavour of a couple to understand the nature of what these proposals are. Point 3. The Greek president of the House of Representatives and the Turkish vice president are to be elected by the House as a whole. Sounds democratic, you say. But before this, The Greek Cypriot president and Turkish Cypriot vice were voted for by their respective ethnic members of the House, therefore always ensuring both communities are represented at these high positions. If changed to a whole majority vote, well, the Greek Cypriots would have had an immediate advantage because they already outnumbered Turkish Cypriot members by 7-3. Point 12. All decisions of the Public Service Commission to be taken by simple majority. Again, I put to you, who held the majority of members in the first instance? Point 1. The right of veto for the President and the Vice President of the Republic against any law or decision to be abandoned. This, of course, would mean Makarios himself losing the right to veto. But in reality, if no law or decision by the government had a balance of representation between Greeks and Turkish Cypriots in the first instance, as per point 12, Makarios probably knew that nothing would need vetoing anyway, because Greek Cypriots would hold the majority vote on all legislation. Now, I'm giving a slightly biased opinion here, it could be construed, so let's try to look at this another way. Makarios was legitimately struggling to achieve anything at both national and municipal level. Any motions made to improve the lives of Greek Cypriots was vetoed or watered down by Turkish Cypriots, and vice versa. Neither community was benefiting from independence or the political status quo. Instead, Makarios claimed that the situation was a key factor in reinforcing the intercommunal friction that was building on the island. So why not attempt to propose radical change? Perhaps the political historians amongst our listeners can share with me some ideas on what he should have done. DM me if you have the solution. Sadly, Makarios did not have the ability to phone a friend, and likely under mounting pressure from the Greek Cypriot community to follow up his promises to make independence a stepping stone towards Enosis still, he delivered his 13-point proposal. Inevitably, the Turkish rejected it. And if Makarios truly believed it would help sew up the divisions between the Cypriot communities, his calculation was not even in the right ballpark. Cynics amongst you may even float the idea that it was his intention all along in an attempt to show the Turkish on an international level as being the problem, the ones not willing to compromise or advance the constitution. But could he have calculated just how wrong his proposals would be taken? I'm not convinced. Listen to the next part after the break and decide for yourself if you think Makarios intended to cause more bloodshed in Cyprus. It's December the 21st, 1963. Just weeks since Makarios III has proposed his radical changes to the Cypriot constitution. The atmosphere between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots is tense. Most people avoid each other. Communities are still largely woven together, living side by side, but increasingly neighbourhoods are dominated by one faction or the other. In Nicosia, as is the centre for so much in Cypriot history, a spark is lit. A Greek Cypriot police patrol stops a Turkish Cypriot couple on the edge of the Turkish quarter. They ask to check identity documents. There is some hostility between them. A crowd begins to gather around the police patrol, who are now feeling threatened. And in the commotion that follows, the police draw their pistols on the crowd, shooting dead two Turkish Cypriots as they attempt to flee the scene. This is the domino that falls and begins a wave of intercommunal fighting never before witnessed on the island. It's not even comparable to Ioka of the 1950s. Tit-for-tat killings begin. Friends are quickly turning into enemies as TMT takes up arms in an attempt to defend Turkish areas around the island. The Greek Cypriot National Guard, the military force that is still in its infancy, begins to round up males from Turkish villages. Some are never heard from again. Some are lucky enough to be put into prisons and camps, although the fate of their families are left to young Greek Cypriots who are fueled by anger and propaganda. Many have family connections to those now killed by TMT members, or wounded, and whom in an attempt to quell the Greek Cypriot action are targeting the leadership of the Greek Cypriot municipalities, who are viewed as either ordering the National Guard to carry out its actions, or at least they believe them to be complicit in the Turkish Cypriot disappearances. The level of violence that follows is absolutely unrecognisable of Cypriot people as I know them. I remember visiting a memorial, a museum almost, in northern Cyprus in 2020, which was displaying images of people's homes from this period, known as Bloody Christmas. Images of families in bathtubs after mass shootings, all in black and white, except for the blood, which had been digitally turned red. It was incredibly powerful and moving, but also demonstrated the horrors of this time. There are countless reports of young men bursting into homes and indiscriminately firing shotguns. There is fear amongst the population. I heard recently a devastating story about a young Turkish Cypriot lady whose father refused to let her seek medical treatment for her newborn baby in Nicosia, where the only incubators were on the island. He feared what might happen to her on the journey to the hospital, possibly how she would be treated if she even got there, as the main hospital was dominated by Greek Cypriots in terms of the administration and the doctors, etc. He felt it was futile, and so he'd effectively condemned his grandchild to the fate he feared would happen. That newborn, it did not survive. It's just one of so many saddening tales I've discovered. Question is, did Makarios, a bishop of the Greek Orthodox Church, really want this? I'm still not convinced, but he certainly is part of the reason that Cyprus descends into what can only be described as anarchy. Estimates are that as much as 1,000 Turkish Cypriot men are killed between 63 to 64. Many of them are dumped in mass graves, which are not to be uncovered for decades to come. 30,000 Turkish Cypriot families are forced to flee their homes and live in refugee camps. Albeit, there are some reports that suggest TMT fighters encouraged the Turkish communities to bind together in these new enclaves, as they're known, around the island. Regardless, the plight for the Turkish Cypriots in 1963 and 64 is irrefutable. Don't get me wrong, TMT exacerbate the situation by killing a few hundred Greek Cypriots, mostly in retaliation killings, and these are not justified. But I want to be clear on the history here, because much of this is either forgotten about, ignored, or even refused to be spoken of in the Republic of Cyprus to this day. It's as if, from 1960, Cyprus was a peaceful island and nothing untoward happened until 1974, when Turkey randomly invaded and there is mass killing, rape and pillage of Greek Cypriot villages. Also, historical fact. Just rarely are we told these stories side by side. I'm really sorry if that is upsetting for anyone listening, and I'm sure too many Cypriots do not want to hear this, but it is so important to confront this part of history. A slight side note here before we move on. I cannot recommend enough a new documentary, The Divided Island, made by the team at Too Fresh in Hertfordshire, England. Hopefully it will soon be hitting the mainstream for us all to see. I have been lucky enough to view it, and as soon as you get an opportunity, you must see it too. The reason I mention it now is because it does a much better job than I could ever in describing and bringing to life the tragedy of 1963-64. Just make sure you have tissues at the ready with you. Like I said, there is alternate viewpoints to the events that take place in Cyprus following Makarios's 13 points proposal. And there is atrocities committed by both Greek and Turkish Cypriots during this period. But the numbers speak for themselves. It's the Turkish Cypriots who are persecuted in the majority leading into 1964. Whilst all this human suffering is happening on the ground in Cyprus, you're probably imagining that the international community is horrified and trying to take action to prevent further atrocities from occurring. But no. The world is distracted in the most. President Kennedy has just been assassinated in November 1963. The Vietnam War is entering a particularly brutal period of its own. Britain is still thwarting with issues of the end of empire and imprisoning the likes of Nelson Mandela in 1964. Nonetheless, there is a conference held in London between the guarantor powers for peace. So Britain, Turkey and Greece, and of course, the Republic of Cyprus. However, now the Cypriot government is devoid of any Turkish Cypriot members because they're refusing to be party of any form of government or council that has been ineffective at preventing the rise of ethnic violence. And as mentioned already, in the main, it's being committed against the Turkish community. Now, the talks failed to conclude anything meaningful. And so, at the request of the Cyprus government, the United Nations sends a special envoy to the island, and within a month of reporting back to the Secretary General of the UN, a peacekeeping force is authorised and deployed to the island of Cyprus in March 1964. If you did not already pick up on this, that's 10 years prior to the Turkish invasion of 1974. So what the heck happened, you ask? What did the UN do for a decade? And how did the island become divided with UN presence already established on the island? Let's find out in the next episode. 60 years prior, as the UN forces in Cyprus come into being. Forever known as UNFISA. Thank you for listening to Cyprus Untold. If you would like any questions answered on the podcast, or you'd like to submit your supporting stories, photographs and memories of Cyprus throughout the ages, please message me direct on Instagram or YouTube at Cyprus Untold. Alternatively, send via email to info@ceasefire.world. Remember to like, subscribe and share wherever you get your podcast. For now, Hoshikel and Dio. Goodbye.